Tom Gimbels, the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Hey, Tom, welcome back to the show.
Hey, John, good to be with you. I love a good smash burger.
I have never had one.
Oh, come on.
I said, that's a good thing, huh?
No, listen, you're coming over to the house. I'm going to make you a smash
burger. Talk to me about rebuilding trust after somebody has made a mistake at work. This is on your radar. What's your thought about this?
Well, there's a couple things that happen. It depends on the mistake. But let's go under the assumption the employee realizes they made the mistake versus blaming other people or feeling that they're getting blamed inappropriately. So you're an employee. You make a big mistake. You know, this isn't like sending the email with typos on it. You make a real big mistake, and the you know what hits the fan. How do you overcome it? And I think first and foremost, there's got to be an authentic apology. You've got to really believe you made a mistake. And then you've got to do a heartfelt apology to the people that were impacted by it. Whether it's external people or internal people, it's an email with sincere thoughts. Like it should take you a while to get your feelings down on paper. And then a follow-up phone call to the people, if not a meeting in person, to say, hey, I realize I did this. I realize it affected you in a negative way. And I'm sorry. And that goes a really, really long way. And then to realize that you probably have to rebuild some trust that you're competent to not make those mistakes again. And it's taking little steps, baby steps. You've got to be comfortable with not having the ultimate trust on the other side back at you, but to earn it. And that's not a bad thing.
Do you reply all? Is this a group email?
No, I think it really depends on the level of people who are involved. And you've got to use some emotional intelligence, which you and I have talked about before. But I think first and foremost, a group email is, hey, team, if it's internally,
yeah.
Hey, team, I want to let you know that I realize how badly I messed this up. If it's external and internal, then you got to be careful on that. And then to follow up, you want to do it individually. Like, take the time, do it, and realize if you made a mistake, you may not be able to do all this during the day. So it may be on your own time on a Saturday or Sunday to really put some thought into it. And I'm a big fan of reflection. So it's almost like take a look at the entire experience and then write out what happened and then write out what you should have done differently and share that with the powers that be, that you've actually taken the time to reflect and know where the mistake was made and what you could have done differently.
Give me a short answer to this, Tom. What's an example of the level of or kind of mistake you're talking about?
Well, let's say that you're in accounting or payroll and you process payroll for somebody who's not there anymore and you can't get the money back, or you're relying on somebody else to do it, or you're an accountant and you didn't reconcile the accounts the right way and it cost the money X amount of dollars, or you're in marketing and yet you didn't post the social media when you were supposed to, that affects the timing of raising money or something. There's a whole lot of levels of different mistakes you can make.
But you're not saying I said something inappropriate at the coffee machine, you know, some sort of interpersonal gap.
No, you're talking about something
of consequence here.
Correct. If you suffer from foot and mouth disease, you want to write an apology to somebody, acknowledge it, and then keep your mouth shut for a few weeks. But I'm talking about something that cost the company money or cost you guys a deal or something like that, where there's some, it's not just about emotions and feelings, it's about revenue to the company.
And then you've got to own it and you've got to be sincere about it and you have to have reflected on it, says Tom Gimbel, the smash burger guru from LaSalle Network. I'm going to take you up on that sometime, Tom.
I'll see you Saturday. I'll get the Blackstone ready for you.
I don't even know what that means. Farron Dogs is the founder and CEO at the Harrison Wallace Financial Group. And we asked Farron to join us today and kind of predict, I don't know if you want to do this or not, Farron, but what do you think is going to happen at the November and December Fed meetings, given the nice run we've had in the markets here?
Hey, John, how are you? Thanks for having me. That's a great question. And I think with some of the data that they're starting to see, I think that are going to be still increased, but I think they're going to pull back on their 75 basis points. My prediction is a 50 basis points increase in the rate for this next meeting. And I think they're in a situation where they're starting to see some elements of the economy start to slow. Most notably, housing. You know, we're seeing that primarily due to the interest rates, but we're also seeing it in new car sales. We're starting to see it in some of the consumer discretionary products, and that's really what they want to see. And it's interesting because they're using kind of lagging data to make future decisions, right? And so I think they're really going to be conscientious about not overdoing this, because they don't necessarily want to throw us into a deep recession. But with all this tightening, if they continue at the rate they are, there's a greater likelihood that recession is going to come to light, which I would expect, truthfully, probably first quarter, second quarter next year.
Well, you're not the first person to time it that way. What do you think the reaction would be if it was 50 basis points?
50, I think we'll actually see a little bit of more of a rally in the market. I think we're starting to see the expectation of that. And over the last week and a half, I believe that because sentiment was so low and, you know, we are starting to see those slowdowns in those sectors I referred to earlier, I think that people are saying, oh, maybe the Fed won't be quite so aggressive on this. And so that's why I think we're starting to see a little bit of this rally. I think if we do just get a 50 basis point, it's going to just corroborate that. And we may see some new money coming into this market. There's a lot of money on the sidelines right now. And people, you know, can't keep up with inflation if it's just sitting in, you know, even though interest rates have gone up, they just can't keep up with inflation. You know, if they're getting 3% and we have inflation at 8%, you're still losing 5%. Right.
Especially if you think the market's going to go up 6%. I mean, that's
right.
That's what's been happening of late. So you're saying that this is the baking in of confidence that the Fed is going to maybe in December only go up 50 basis points. This is the anticipation of that?
I think it is. Yes. And also valuations. I think we were starting to see such negativity in the market, and a lot of, as I mentioned, a lot of people have, you know, some cash to put to work. And I don't think they're diving in. You know, we're not seeing incredible volumes just diving in. But we are starting to see some nibbling. And I think that that's good. People should be dollar cost averaging into this market, especially if they have a longer term time horizon. But that being said, I don't think people should, you know, sit back and say, oh, the worst is over. Because I do believe that, you know, going into the first and second quarter next year could get quite rocky.
What gets rocky?
Well, I think the markets as a whole, I don't think we're necessarily through all of this. So what I would say is if you have some cash needs in the next year or two, and you know you're going to have those expenditures, make sure you have that money in something more stable and secure. Don't be trying to time this market, and don't be trying to say, well, I think I can get higher than my 3%. Because if you're going to have that cash need, it's going to be there whether the market's up 10% or down another 10%.
Yeah.
But on the intermediate and long-term things, I think an investor should be, you know, dollar cost averaging in and taking advantage of these lower prices. It's not going to be a smooth, steady ride. But, you know, you have to kind of keep your eye on your time frame.
Some cautious optimism from Farron Dawgs, founder and CEO, Harrison Wallace Financial Group. HarrisonWallace.com is the website for more. Farron, we'll call again. Thanks for your thoughts today.
All right. Thanks, John. Have a good day.
Dennis Rodkin is here. He is the residential real estate reporter at Crain's. There's lots of trends and big picture things to talk about, but let's just dive into the juicy stuff. You wrote about a Lake Geneva estate built for a meatpacking dynasty that sold on Lake Geneva. Is it a lake house?
Yeah. 500 feet of Lake Geneva frontage.
Is that a big deal, 500 feet of Lake Geneva?
It's a lot. I think the only one with more is next door.
Oh, 500 feet. Well, that's almost two football fields.
Yeah,
that's a lot. And Lake Geneva, very nice, very well-to-do. How much did that house sell for?
$17 million. It had been on the market for nearly 21, for $20.75 million.
No kidding. They came down from 20.75?
Well, they put it on the market in 2021 for 20.75. They came down $2 million. They were asking 18.7. went off the market. And as I understand it from the agent, it was no longer on the market. And somebody came along and said, we'll give you 17. And they took it.
Hmm. Wonder what they paid for it. I wonder what they had in that bad boy.
You know, they bought it in 1997. When they put it on the market, I spoke with them. They wouldn't say what they paid for it, and the records for Lake Geneva, I couldn't find what they paid in 97. But this is kind of interesting. It was a second home. The people who just sold it, not the people who bought it, who owned it since 1997, they were a Kenosha family. Almost everybody had moved to Florida, and they wanted a place where they could hang out in Wisconsin in the summer. So they bought this 20-acre, 18-room estate, 12,000-square-foot mansion, as I said, 500 feet of lake frontage, that today is worth $17 million. Again, I don't know what they paid at the time. They did a fair amount of rehab. It probably needs another round because they did it 25 years ago.
And what did these people do to get their money?
They were in finance. They were at various levels of financial management.
Okay. So that's the people that have sold that. And who did they sell it to?
I don't yet know. It just sold on Friday, so I don't yet know who bought it.
Somebody wrote a note on their door. That happens sometimes, but usually...
But not at $17 million. Yeah.
We saw your house. We love the shutters. $17 million, final offer. Do you put that on the note?
Well, in this case, you might have seen the house from the tour boat out on Lake Geneva.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of those mansions that they point out on the tour. It's been there since 1904, built for the Swifts, the meatpacking Swifts. And so it's possible somebody was riding by on the boat and said, I'd like that. Let me run up and put a note on the door.
It's got granite, central air, everything?
No, actually, it has. I think the kitchen is dated. Didn't get full pictures. They didn't give full pictures at the time. Kitchen needs a rehab.
Seriously?
Yeah. And, you know, do you need air conditioning when you're on the shores of Lake Geneva with all kinds of doors and windows that fly open and you can catch the breeze?
I do.
You do.
I'll tell you what, if I give you $17 million, I'm getting central air. If I need it once a year, I want my central air. I mean,
so what you're telling me is you did not buy this mansion because that was what I was going to.
$17 million. It's 93 degrees. It's humid as hell on Lake Geneva, and you're going, wow, I am really uncomfortable in my $17 million house.
You could go next door to the $36 million house and use their air conditioning.
Boy, there's everybody looking at the next guy's boat.
Yeah,
I mean. $17 million, but really it's only half the house next door. The Johnsons have got a really nice place.
Yeah.
Who are the neighbors?
In this case, the Reyes. So these are the two highest priced homes ever sold in Lake Geneva, both sold this year. The $36 million one sold in January. That was the Driehaus estate, Richard Driehaus, who died in 2021. His estate put it up for sale. He had also bought that in the 90s. He bought it and rehabbed it in time to have a turn of the millennium party. Rehabbed it like crazy. It was spectacular. Put it on, and again, it came on the market after his death, sold for $36 million in January. This one we're talking about now had already been on the market for quite a while when the next door neighbor, the Driehaus Mansion, went on and then off the market. And now it has sold for $17 million. So once again, those Lake Geneva tour boats, I think they're rewriting their scripts.
I wonder if that increases or decreases the value. You know, people that have that kind of money usually want some privacy. And then there's John Williams, you know, with a Miller Lite in his hand, floating offshore, going, I wonder what they do.
You know, I think in Lake Geneva, you get used to it. Oh, actually, you know, there's one advantage that this $17 million one has, but I think they all get used to it because, you know, there's this tradition that anybody can walk all the way around the lake. There's this trail. You could go on to the Driehaus
on their property
estate. There is one interesting distinction for the $17 million one. There's essentially a shelf. So you're on a lower shelf when you're on that trail, obscured from the house. So those people, when they're in their mansion, aren't looking down toward the lake and watching the hoi polloi walk by, while an awful lot of people in Lake Geneva sit in their multi-million dollar mansions and you see people cruising by on your shoreline. These people, maybe that's what made it a $17 million home. They don't have to see the hoi polloi.
You know, you can't use all the rooms. I think all of us would love to have a $36 million house, but then I think a lot of us, what do you do with the 36? What do those people do in there? What do you do with it? You know, so it's awesome. It's beautiful. Do you walk around and take in the splendor, or is it really just an investment that you get to live in, you know?
Well, Driehaus was famous for having these giant parties.
Really?
He would, year after year, I never went to one, but you can hardly throw a stick in Chicago and not hit somebody who's been to one of these parties. He came in, he would show up in dressed up like a circus
clown
impresario.
Oh, okay.
He would ride a horse in. Yeah. He showed up in miniature cars, those kinds of things. There was a theme every year.
Oh, nice.
And it was, he would have these gigantic parties. And often in the early 2000s, you'd see them written up in the Tribune. I don't know what that the Reyeses will continue that tradition. But don't forget that, you know, if you buy a $36 million house, it's not your only one. This family also has properties in Florida and elsewhere. So you go to Lake Geneva when you want to enjoy the Wisconsin summer.
Yeah.
And other times you're elsewhere.
Yeah. Wow. Boy, that's spectacular. $17 million, the neighbor's $36 million. You think the $36 million guy put the note on the $17 million guy door?
I would not be surprised. We don't yet know who bought the $17 million property, but we have seen this happen where people with a giant mansion buy the one next door.
Yeah, it's a tear down. We're just, you know, we need the real estate. We're going to tear down the 17 mil and do something proper with that land. It's 1244. This is WGN. Okay, that's what's going on in Wisconsin. Let's talk about the real estate market in general in Chicago and suburbs in a minute with Dennis Rodkin. You read him regularly in Crane's Chicago Business. First, let's get more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The McRib is coming back to McDonald's, and this could be the last time fans get it. The sandwich is returning to menus October 31st for a limited time. Statement from McDonald's says this could be your last chance to taste it because it won't be sold nationally for a while following this promotion. They're calling this a farewell tour. The company does leave the door open for a possible return of the McRib at some point. McDonald's first added it to the menus in 1981 in Kansas City. The chain pulled it from its menu 4 years later, but it has become a cult favorite among McDonald's loyalists. American Airlines is creating its own feeder system for airplane mechanics here in Chicago. The carrier announced a new partnership with the Aviation Institute of Maintenance on the South Side. American will provide guidance and assistance for students at the institute, with the top 20% in the class receiving guaranteed interviews with the airline. Industry experts estimate a need for 600,000 airline mechanics over the next two decades. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir. We are sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDrivesChicago.com. The Illinois State High School football playoffs begin this week, but one champion has already been crowned. And here's Mr. Simpson to help us out.
This is a place of pork chops.
Yes, Homer, the best concession stand pork chop in the land of Lincoln goes to Hall High School in Spring Valley.
Thank you.
That's Eric Bryant. He's athletic director and assistant principal at Hall High School.
I tell you what, our guys were really excited about it, and our community was pretty excited about it.
58 schools entered. It was narrowed down to 16, the savory 16, and after a panel of experts tasted them all, how does one get that gig? The winner was Hall High. It's concession stand run by
our Hall Booster organization. We call them HBO.
And to give credit where credit's due,
Julie Eilers, Tracy Morris, Kelly Whitesoul, and Jen Jablonski are four of the ladies that put together the concession stand.
And outside, manning a grill about the size of a ping pong table,
Lee Simmons, Josh Simpson, Dan Simpson, Scott May, Dustin Davis, Tony Schoen, and Kyle Kaczynski.
Hundreds of pork chop sandwiches are served every home game, and money from the concession stand helps the whole school.
Anything from Chromebooks to bulletin boards to computers for teachers.
Yeah, that's great. Let's talk about the sandwich, whose pork comes from a local retailer. How does it taste?
Super tender with just that little bit of seasoning, and I don't even know exactly what it is. I don't know if they would even tell me, but it's super delicious.
He says barbecue sauce is available, but most people don't even bother. Au naturel is perfecto. Congrats to the Hall High School concession stand folks for winning the best pork chop sandwich in Illinois for 2022. The IHSA and the Illinois Pork Producers awarded them $500 to buy pork chops next season, and they were given the coveted golden spatula. Oh, as for the football team, the Red Devils are in the playoffs for the first time in a few years. They take on the Cyclones of top-ranked Sacred Heart Griffin this weekend. From the farm to your belly, today is National Greasy Food Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Dennis Rodkin's in our studio. You read him regularly as the residential real estate reporter at Crain's Chicago Business. So you told us a little bit about some fascinating places on Lake Geneva in Wisconsin. How are home values in the Chicago area holding up?
Home values are holding up. Prices have not started going down yet, except in isolated areas. Just got data today and also some data last week showing that our price growth is narrowing. It's getting smaller all the time. But remember that that's price growth on top of those boom years. So we're still topping those prices just by less than we were. However, we're not crumbling like a lot of cities. The story I put out today was about the Case-Shiller Index, which is a good national barometer of prices. Our prices in August were up about 11%, 16th month in a row that our prices were up 11% or more. Compare that to there were five cities where their growth is shrinking fast. Miami and Tampa are rising, but Phoenix, San Diego, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, their price growth has shrunk. In Phoenix, this time a year ago, prices were up 33%. Now they're up 17% from a year ago. Once again, that's on top of their boom numbers, so it's not unimpressive that their prices are up 17%, but it's shrinking real fast. San Diego down by half as well, Washington. San Francisco, prices were up this time last year, 21% from the year before. Now they're up 5.6% from the year before.
And what are our numbers?
Our numbers, we're still up 11%. We've been going up 11, 12, 13% month over month for 16 months now. So the point is, they're seeing it start to shrink, and we're not. They inflated super fast. Phoenix, like I said, their prices were going up. They were up 30% month after month after month in the Case-Shiller Index during 2021, early 2022. That is unsustainable. If you're a home buyer, your affordability is just like galloping away from you. And so it has started to ease up. Here, it was getting difficult for us to afford homes. Prices were going up fast. But we remain one of the most affordable big cities in America.
That's a nice way to put it. It's more sustainable. It's also just more practical. I mean, of course, 35% must be reflective of something other than the inherent value of the real estate. I presume that was the pandemic. Is that what was happening?
Yeah, and I think it was froth. I think it was, you know, I can afford so much at these low interest rates. I'll get whatever I can.
Right.
And everybody else thinks the same thing, so we're all bidding against one another.
But you said home values are staying the same, but with interest rates, I would imagine that you wouldn't be getting more for your house these days.
Well, I think soon we will. These are lagging indicators we're talking about. I think soon we could start to see prices coming down, but so far they have not started to crumble yet.
So talk to me about the volume then of sales. I presume that's off.
Yeah. Last week, there were fewer new homes put on the market and fewer homes put under contract than at any time since the beginning of the pandemic. So that means both buyers putting homes under contract and sellers putting homes on the market were less busy in the market than at any time since February 2020. Some people think that that's seasonal. You know, the market tends to slow down in the fall. But last fall and the fall of 2020, it didn't slow down. So this is where we're really starting to see it's over.
Well, maybe the churn was going to have a lifespan of its own, and obviously interest rates can't be helping.
I think the churn probably would have had a lifespan of its own. But one of the reasons the Federal Reserve started jacking up interest rates was because everybody thought, well, how long can this go on? This has gotten nuts. So let's not let it live out its own lifespan. Let's start to reel it in. And so one of the things to keep in mind is this is all intentional.
Right.
Federal Reserve raised rates, hoping that, among other things, mortgage rates would go up, which would slow all that froth in the market in Phoenix, San Francisco, as well as in Chicago.
So this is a feature, not a bug,
exactly,
of what the Fed is doing. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dennis Rodkin. Read more. His writing and reporting is always just so intriguing, isn't it? And timely. You can find out more at chicagobusiness.com. That's chicagobusiness.com. Dennis Rodkin is Crain's residential real estate reporter. Dennis, you'll visit us again, I trust?
I hope so, John.
It's always nice to see you.